Ladies and gentlemen, in approaching the subject of this evening's lecture, the question of the existence of God, I must confess to a certain feeling of embarrassment. It seems rather incongruous to have to debate in the 20th century, in an air-conditioned, electrically illuminated room, through a microphone, a belief which, at least since the time that he emerged from the cave, has been singularly unbecoming to man. But the belief in God has not disappeared along with the belief in witches and demons, as it should have centuries ago. And the disastrous consequences of this belief are such as to necessitate our discussing the issue tonight. In a crucial sense, this lecture differs from all the lectures that precede and follow it. It is concerned primarily with the analysis of an error, with the analysis of a belief which is not true. The other lectures are all primarily positive, in that they are concerned with establishing that which is true. They are concerned with affirming, not with negating. But this concern with a negative is necessary in the name of and in the defense of the highest of positives. It is necessary in the name of and in the defense of man's mind. For I shall demonstrate that faith in God implies and necessitates the invalidation and the undercutting of man's consciousness. In the three preceding lectures, I have discussed the fact that reason and faith are irreconcilable opposites. I have stated that reason is the means by which man acquires knowledge of reality, that man's knowledge has a hierarchical structure, that wider and more complex concepts rest and depend on earlier, simpler concepts, and that the total has to be integrated into a non-contradictory whole if it is to represent a true and valid knowledge of reality. And that this can be done only if all of man's knowledge, everything that he accepts as true, is derived from the observation of reality. In order for an idea or concept to be integrated into man's consciousness and the sum of his knowledge, certain conditions are necessary. First, the concept must be clearly grasped and firmly defined. Second, one must know the reasons for holding that concept, the reasons that validate it. Third, the concept must never be closed to further scrutiny or examination. It must never be held exempt from rational judgment, meaning it must never be held exempt from the facts of reality. But if one introduces an arbitrary element into one's consciousness, if one introduces into one's knowledge and convictions an idea that one holds without rational justification, an idea which is not derived from reality and which is not subject to rational examination, that is, an idea accepted on faith, while then no further integration is possible, such an idea cannot be placed within a logical hierarchy or structure of concepts. It acts to paralyze the thinking process by setting up irreconcilable conflicts. Faith is the acceptance of an idea without evidence or proof, without sensory evidence or logical demonstration. Because no idea taken on faith can be rationally integrated, but can only leave the total of one's premises in a state of unresolved contradiction, the introduction of any idea taken on faith results in the total undercutting of man's knowledge. Because man's power of integration has been sabotaged, man, in effect, loses the capacity to be certain of anything. And further, man is forced to feel that reason and thinking are superfluous. If reason is not the only means of perceiving reality, if one can gain knowledge by some other method, then man has no cause to maintain the rigorous, exacting discipline of rational thought, since some other means of information may contradict and negate these results at any time and in any issue. This is what Galt meant when he said that the alleged shortcut to knowledge, which is faith, is only a short circuit destroying the mind. Now, these considerations apply to any act of faith, regardless of the specific content of the idea that a man might decide to accept on faith. the efficacy of his consciousness would be impaired even if it were a true idea that a man accepted on faith. That is, accepted without understanding, without the necessary chain of proof, without first-hand knowledge or logical conviction. But the damage to his consciousness becomes multiplied many times when he accepts ideas on faith that contradict reality and therefore contradict and undercut the rest of his knowledge, any rational knowledge he may possess or ever acquire. By attempting to grasp, to hold, to deal with the rationally unintegratable, the contradictory, the unintelligible, man's consciousness is forced to turn against itself, to invalidate its own power of sight, to pronounce itself impotent, impotent by nature. A more terrifying conflict cannot be projected or imagined, yet that is the conflict to which men condemn themselves when they accept faith in God, or any form of faith in the supernatural. Let us examine the concept of God and observe some of its striking implications for man's consciousness. To begin with, those who profess to believe in God are unable to identify or communicate intelligibly what it is that they believe in. What is the nature, the identity of God? What is the meaning of the concept? God is something, they say, only I don't know what it is. They claim to believe in it, nevertheless. No philosophy, theology, or religion has ever given a rationally intelligible definition or even description of the nature of God or any intelligible content to the concept God. Observe that I said intelligible. A great many descriptions have been offered and a great many attributes have been ascribed to God, but they are of a kind that represents a negation and a mockery of man's consciousness, as well as of everything known to him in reason about the nature of reality. For instance, God, claim the mystics, is infinite. What does it mean to be infinite? It means to possess no limits, to possess no specific, determinate, finite number of attributes, no specific, particular, identifiable qualities. It means to be nothing in particular. But to be nothing in particular is not to be. Existence is identity. To assert that an infinite being exists is to assert that something can exist that possesses no identity, that is nothing in particular. To accept the existence of a being who possesses no identity, one has to reject the law of identity. But to reject the law of identity is to reject the total of one's grasp of reality. Thus, the concept of an infinite God is the destruction of man's concept of existence, of being. God, claim the mystics, is pure spirit or pure consciousness. What do they mean by spirit? Well, in rational terms, the concept spirit is intelligible and simply means man's consciousness. Consciousness in rational terms means the faculty of awareness possessed by a specific material living entity. But this is not what the mystics mean. By pure spirit, they mean a non-material entity, and by pure consciousness, they mean a faculty without any entity to which it belongs. What is a non-material entity? The mystics have no identification for it and no definition, no concept except the negation of man's concept. Non-material means simply non-anything you know. Spirit, in the mystics' terms, is not something specific or identifiable. Its nature is precisely that it cannot be identified. It is not to be grasped by man. It is not merely different from matter, which is the metaphysical opposite of matter. It is that which matter is not. To grasp it, you must reject everything which you do grasp and replace it with the concept of that which is not what I grasp. In terms of man's consciousness, to grasp means to understand, to identify. The definition of spirit offered by the mystics is, in effect, that which is not to be identified by man. The same epistemological devastation is performed by the mystics' concept of pure consciousness. Man's concept of consciousness is a faculty belonging to a specific being who possesses specific means of awareness, such as sense organs, nose, the brain, which make it possible for him to be aware of reality in the form of sensations, perceptions, conceptions. But the mystic's concept of pure consciousness is a faculty without an entity, a faculty that exists by itself and is conscious without any specific means of awareness, an action without an entity that acts, the action of an unlimited entity, unlimited by any specific means. This is not only the destruction of the law of identity, but also the acceptance of the one epistemological method which destroys a rational consciousness, the dropping of context. Logic, man's means of cognition, requires the preservation of the full context of every concept man forms. To accept the idea of a pure consciousness, man must drop the context, the meaning, the root of consciousness as he knows it, and replace it with the idea of a consciousness which is not what I know or mean or grasp. Thus, the doctrine of God is pure consciousness is the destruction of the concept of consciousness. God, claimed by mystics, is omnipotent. What does omnipotent mean? It means that God can do anything. Since the actions possible to an entity are determined by the nature of the entity that acts, for God to be unrestricted in action, he would have to be unrestricted in identity. And this would mean that he possesses no identity. If God is omnipotent, not only does he possess no identity, but neither does anything else possess identity. Think about that. God can do anything to any entity, and he can make any entity do anything, regardless of the entity's nature, which is tantamount to saying that the entity has no nature. Anything goes. Anything is possible. If miracles can happen, reality is fluid, arbitrary, unpredictable, unknowable. A miracle is the rationally impossible. If God is omnipotent, contradictions have to be possible. This raises a number of questions, the sole meaning of which is a mockery of man's reason. For example, it has been asked, can God tie a knot that he cannot untie? Or can God create a mountain that he cannot climb over? The answer given by the mystics is, you must not try to understand, you must believe. You must believe that that which is inconceivable to you is possible. And that that which you do conceive of, such as specific identifiable entities, can be negated and dissolved by miracle at any moment. Thus, the concept that God is omnipotent destroys the law of identity and the law of causality. God, claimed the mystics, is omniscient. To be omniscient means to know everything, past, present, and future. Observe that the attribute of omniscience is necessitated by the attribute of omnipotence. In order for God to be able to do anything, he would have to know everything. But observe also that the attributes of omnipotence and omniscience contradict each other. In order for God to know everything, everything would have to be fated and predetermined. But if everything were fated and predetermined, it could not be changed. And if it could not be changed, this is a limitation on God's potency, and he is not omnipotent. Here again, the mystic will tell you, don't think, don't examine, don't wonder, don't question, believe. The concept of omniscience is the secret wish fulfillment of every mystic. To acquire one's knowledge by a process of struggle and effort is abhorrent to the mystic. But to know everything, to know it instantaneously and without effort, to know it causelessly without any specific means of knowing it, or acquiring one's knowledge, or holding one's knowledge, this is the mystic's passionate dream. The concept of omniscience is a psychological monument to the mystic's hatred of effort. Finally, the mystics claim that God is all good. This means that he is incapable of evil. This poses a number of problems. The first is, if he is incapable of evil, how can he be omnipotent? Or consider another problem. Consider what is meant by the concept good. The concept of good or evil can pertain only to a being who has the power of choice. Morality applies only to entities who have a choice of action. If a robot were constructed for a certain job which it executed flawlessly because it was so designed by a scientist, you would not call it a virtuous robot. You would know that the robot has no power of choice and that it does only what it has to do. But if God is incapable of choosing evil, then he is as amoral as that robot. If God has no power to choose evil, if by nature he must always and automatically choose the good, then he is outside the concept of morality and his actions cannot be described as either good or evil. The doctrine of God is all good creates an enormous problem which the mystics have never been able to solve. It is known as the problem of evil, and it consists of the question, if God is omnipotent and all good, why does he allow evil to exist in the world? The philosopher Epicurus expressed this problem thus, either God would remove evil out of this world and cannot, or he can and will not, or he has not the power nor will, or lastly, he has both the power and will. If he has the will and not the power, this shows weakness, which is contrary to the nature of God. If he has the power and not the will, it is malignity, and this is no less contrary to his nature. And if he is neither able nor willing, he is both impotent and malignant, and consequently cannot be God. And if he is both willing and able, which alone is consonant with the nature of God, whence comes evil, or why does he not prevent it? Theologians have been painfully aware of this problem, and they have offered a number of answers. The most common answer is that man's limited intellect cannot grasp the mystery. That God, in fact, works for good purposes, but the purposes are of a kind which man's reason cannot grasp. So, if we see innocents slaughtered by the millions and the seemingly evil prosper, and if it seems to us that we are witnessing something evil, why, it is only an illusion. It is not evil. By God's standard, it is good. If you see your loved ones being tortured and murdered, do not dare consider it evil. Do not dare pass any moral judgment. It merely seems evil from your limited viewpoint. It serves a good end from God's viewpoint, which you cannot grasp and must not question. If God wills it to be so, who are you to call it evil or to protest? Thus, the doctrine of God is all good is, ladies and gentlemen, the destruction of morality. Observe that the mystics' answer to all the problems and contradictions involved in the concept of God is, your mind cannot conceive of it. If your mind cannot conceive of the irrational, the contradictory, the senseless, the impossible, it is your mind that must take the blame. The ultimate brain killer is the mystics' claim that God is unknowable. Do not confuse the concept of unknowable with the concept of unknown. Unknown merely means something not known at present or not known to you. But unknowable means that which can never be known, that which by its nature cannot be known. The most consistent theory of the mystics pertaining to God as the unknowable is that of a theological school known as negative theology. The negative theologians insisted that one cannot possibly say what God is because to ascribe any attributes to him is to limit him, and this amounts to an impertinence. One must not say that God is finite, that would limit him. One must not say that God is infinite, that would limit him also, since it forbids him to be finite. One must not say that he is all good, because that implies that he cannot be bad. One must not say that he is good and bad, because that forbids the possibility of his being exclusively one. One must not say that he is omniscient, because that forbids the possibility of his being fallible. One must not say that he is fallible, because that forbids the possibility of his being omniscient. Well, here in this theory, you can observe the full, open, explicit meaning and purpose of the mystics' advocacy of faith in God. The hatred of man's mind and the desire to destroy it. To destroy all the cardinal concepts of man's reason. To destroy the base of man's consciousness, the law of identity. And to leave man on his belly as an abject idiot, staring in terror at a nightmare apparition which he dares not identify as either finite or infinite. The irrationality of those who profess a belief in God is not merely that they cannot adduce any evidence to support their belief, but that they cannot even specify what it is in which they claim to believe. The man who claims to have faith that he will win at cards can at least define what it is in which he has faith, in that the sense that he knows what he means by winning at cards. But if he claims that he has faith in God, he cannot in any like sense specify what he means. He can identify God in effect only as a feeling. He has faith in a feeling. But since faith itself is only the worship of feelings, the man who declares to have faith in God is declaring that he has a feeling about a feeling, the feeling that his feeling is true. Thus, faith in God is mysticism two times over. It is an act of faith twice compounded. Let us now turn to an examination of the kind of facts of reality that, according to the mystics, justify or necessitate a belief in such a being as God. Perhaps the most well-known of such arguments goes as follows. Since everything in the universe requires a cause, must not the universe itself have a cause, which is God? This is best known as the first cause argument. Let us consider it. Since everything in the universe requires a cause, this argument goes, must not the universe itself have a cause, which is God? There are two fallacies in this argument. The first is the assumption that if the universe required a causal explanation, the positing of a God would provide it. To posit God as the creator of the universe is only to push the problem back one step farther. Who then created God? Was there a still earlier God who created the God in question? We are thus led to an infinite regress, the very dilemma that the positing of a God was intended to solve. But if it is argued that no one created God, that God does not require a cause, that God has existed eternally, then on what grounds is it denied that the universe has existed eternally? In other words, once one grasps the concept and necessity of something that always existed but that was not brought into existence, one has overthrown the need for the concept of God and can recognize that the universe has existed eternally. However, there is a second and more fundamental fallacy in this argument, and that is the assumption that the universe as a whole requires a causal explanation. It does not. What is the universe? The universe is the total of that which exists. Within the universe, the emergence of new entities can be explained in terms of the actions of entities that already exist. For example, the cause of a tree is the seed of the parent tree. The cause of a machine is the purposeful reshaping of matter by men. All actions presuppose the existence of entities, and all emergences of new entities presuppose the existence of entities that caused their emergence. All causality presupposes the existence of something that acts as a cause. To demand a cause for all of existence is to demand a contradiction. If the cause exists, it is part of existence. If it does not exist, it cannot be a cause. Nothing cannot be the cause of something. Nothing does not exist. Causality presupposes existence. Existence does not presuppose causality. There can be no cause outside of existence or anterior to it. The forms of existence may change and evolve, but the fact of existence is the irreducible primary at the base of all causal chains. Just as the concept of causality applies to events and entities within the universe, but not to the universe as a whole, so the concept of time applies to events and entities within the universe, but not to the universe as a whole. In other words, the universe did not begin. It did not at some point in time spring into being. Time is a measurement of motion. Motion presupposes entities that move. If nothing existed, there could be no time. Time is in the universe. The universe is not in time. The person who asks, where did existence come from, or what caused it, is the man who has never grasped that existence exists. This is the mentality of a savage or a mystic who regards existence as some sort of incomprehensible miracle, and who seeks to explain it by reference to non-existence. Existence is all that exists. The non-existent does not exist. There is nothing for existence to have come out of, and nothing means nothing. If you are tempted to ask what's outside the universe, recognize that you are asking what's outside of existence, and that the idea of something outside of existence is a contradiction in terms. Nothing is outside of existence, and nothing is not just another kind of something. It is nothing. Existence exists. You cannot go outside it, you cannot get under it, on top of it, or behind it. Existence exists, and only existence exists. There is nowhere else to go. Now, turning to another well-known argument that claims to justify the belief in a God, let us consider the so-called argument from design. This argument goes as follows. Observe the perfect order in the universe. Observe the clock-like regularity of the motion of the planets. Observe the progression of the seasons. Observe how conveniently man is made. He requires oxygen for his survival, and he has lungs. Surely there has to exist a master designer who arranged and planned all this. How else can such an order be explained? Well, let us analyze what it means to state that the universe has order. Observe that this is merely declaring, if one thinks about it, that A is A, though such is scarcely the mystic's intention. What alternative to an ordered universe would a mystic envision? Everything that exists is something, after all. It is what it is, and it can only do that which it can do. An acorn is an acorn, and under appropriate conditions will always grow into an oak. An oak, however, will never shrink back into an acorn. Is this the mysterious regularity that the mystic needs God to explain? The laws of identity and causality make it fully intelligible. We don't need reference to a supernatural entity. The alternative to an ordered universe would be a chaotic universe, meaning a universe where oaks did shrink back into acorns, and then into college professors, and then into cloud formations. A chaotic universe is a universe without identity or causality. Such a universe is impossible, except to the mind of a mystic who has never grasped that A is A, and who looks with wonder on the fact that winter always comes after fall and before spring, rather than sometimes coming after spring and before summer. As for the argument about how wonderfully and conveniently man is made, it is only necessary to observe that he wouldn't be here if he weren't. There were species, after all, whose bodily structure was not so convenient and who consequently died out. Would a mystic explain them as a slip-up on God's part? Obviously, the only species we are familiar with are those whose structure is such as to permit them to survive. Those whose structure is not such are not here for us to study. Still a third argument, closely related to the argument from design, is the argument from life. According to this argument, the proof of God's existence is said to be found in the fact of the existence of life. In mathematical terms, claim the mystics, the possibility that life could have arisen by accident, by chance, is so inconceivably remote as to be virtually impossible. Therefore, the mystics conclude life must have arisen by design, therefore God. This argument rests on offering man two alternatives, both of which are equally irrational and untenable. The two alternatives being that either life came into being by chance or by design. In the metaphysical sense, there is no such thing as chance. In a universe of identity and causality, there are no literal accidents. Chance is a concept pertaining not to reality, but to human knowledge, and in a manner of speaking, to a state of ignorance. Men say that an event happens by chance only because they do not know why, in fact, the event did happen. To give a simple illustration, if I throw a coin in the air, we may say that it is only a matter of chance whether it lands heads or tails. But actually, there are very strict scientific laws that will determine on which side the coin does land, depending upon a number of factors, such as the angle which it is thrown, the velocity, etc., etc. It's not a matter of chance, strictly speaking. It's only chance from the point of view of human knowledge. Another sense in which men sometimes speak of chance is that we say two men met by chance, meaning an event that took place not by someone's conscious intention. But that really is irrelevant to the concept of chance as discussed here. What I want to repeat is that in the metaphysical sense, chance is really a senseless concept. To realize, however, that neither life nor anything else happens by chance is not to conclude that things happen by design. Here again, mystics reveal their failure to understand the laws of identity and causality. That which happens in the universe happens by necessity, by the intrinsic natures of the entities involved. Whether life is some primary element that has always existed, or whether it arose out of a combination of other elements in a manner yet unknown, is a question really quite irrelevant to our purpose here. What is relevant is our understanding that the concept of chance has no metaphysical validity whatever, and that the rational alternative is a recognition of the full meaning and implications of the law of identity, not the positing of some mystical supernatural designer. Now, the attempt to explain events in the universe by means of a god is very, very old. It doubtless goes back far, far into prehistory. Many years ago, while still in college, Leonard Peikoff wrote a rather interesting paper on this subject, from which I would like to quote. Quote, "In what manner was the concept of the divine first formed? Its first appearance was in primitive societies and civilizations. The first form of the concept of the divine was polytheism. Primitive man, living thousands of years before modern science, could not explain why the Nile overflowed at the same time each year. He accepted as an explanation that there was a god of the Nile who directed and controlled its activities. He could not explain why lightning occurred when it did. He accepted the existence of a god of lightning as an explanation. He could not understand why he sometimes won his battles and sometimes lost them. There was, he concluded, a god of war who controls and determines the outcome of battles. Firmly entrenched in the methodology of the primitive man was the following premise. If one does not understand the cause of an event, if one cannot account for it, attribute the cause to a being who controls this kind of phenomenon and call such a being the god of this phenomenon. By this process, the earth was soon populated with hundreds of separate gods, and the population grew as each separate country began to establish its own particular gods. There were Egyptian gods of war, Hebrew gods of war, Babylonian gods of war, and so on, for lightning, vegetation, the sun, the moon, the oceans, etc., etc. Although these gods were anthropomorphically conceived, in that they had material bodies, could be good and evil, and were finite, they nevertheless were thought to surpass man in two respects. They had more knowledge than man, and they had more power than he. Man did not know about lightning, but the god of lightning did know. Man could not make the Nile overflow, but the god of the Nile had that power. And so developed two characteristics which were to remain associated with the concept of God until the present day. Gods have knowledge of and power over the aspects of nature which are theirs." It is perhaps unnecessary to comment at this point upon the invalidity of the methodology of the primitive man. My only reason for doing so is that many people today believe in a God of life for the same reasons. They believe that, since man cannot yet account for the process by which life was born on Earth, it is necessary to explain life to believe in a God who created it. But this methodology, whether employed by primitive man or by moderns, is irrational. When one asks for the explanation of an event, one asks, what is the cause and how does it produce the effect in question? Thus, if one asks for the explanation of lightning, it is an answer to the question to state that certain subatomic particles in the atmosphere, having a certain amount of energy, are made under certain conditions of temperature and pressure to release some of their energy, which released energy then appears to the human eye as a flash of light in the sky. It is not an explanation to state that God caused lightning. Such a response leaves the question unanswered. It merely states that something caused lightning by some means, but it does not state what is the cause nor how it operated. That something causes an event is known in advance. To ask for an explanation is to ask what in particular caused the event and by what means did it do so. Explanation via gods is not explanation. But this primitive methodology over the course of centuries became very firmly entrenched in the minds of men. It became indeed so firmly entrenched that the abstract philosopher, when he appeared on the scene of history, employed it in the identical manner that the primitive Egyptian had. The province of the abstract philosopher is existence as a whole. He is not concerned merely with lightning, oceans, or human psychology. His object of thought is the universe. The primitive man asked, what created lightning? The abstract philosopher asks, what created the universe? The primitive man asked, what is the explanation of lightning? The abstract philosopher asked, what is the explanation of the universe? The primitive man asked, what runs lightning? The abstract philosopher asked, what runs the universe? The primitive man answered all of his questions with the word God. So did the abstract philosopher. The belief that God explains the universe is in the identical epistemological category with the belief that God explains lightning. Both reflect the epistemology of the primitive man of thousands of years ago. The arguments traditionally offered for the existence of God all are reflections on a cosmic scale of the methodology employed by ancient Mesopotamians when they explained floods by attributing them to the god Enlil. This was the approach that led ultimately to the specific characteristics attributed to God by philosophers and theologians. The god of lightning was conceived anthropomorphically as possessing a material body. But the god of the universe could not be thought of as merely another object in the universe. It was necessary for him to be crucially different from anything in the universe, to be non-material, in a word, to be spiritual. The god of lightning needed to possess only limited knowledge, the knowledge of lightning. But the god of everything needed to know everything, in a word, to be omniscient. The god of lightning needed to have only limited power, power over lightning. But the god of all existence needed to have power over all existence, to be omnipotent. The god of lightning could be thought of as limited and finite, for he needed only limited knowledge and power. But the god of the universe was omnipotent and omniscient, and so must be conceived as unlimited and infinite. It was not uncomfortable to conceive of the god of lightning as being capable of evil, for he could be held in check by the gods of thunder and rain. But it is terrifying if the omnipotent, omniscient god of the universe can behave as a monster, and so he was conceived of as all good. It is in this manner, in essence, that the concept of God was formed, a concept which has profoundly influenced over 20 centuries of Western civilization. Close quote.